Vital attempt to gain the assistance of Stalker against Iriden had come during the latter part of summer, bare weeks before the weather turned. Once winter sets in, there's very little serious fighting until spring. Quite a few soldiers go home to plant crops that need a period of cold to grow or just to spend the winter somewhere warmer and more congenial than an armed camp. Airu did not go home, but spent those months in Vastai, drinking mulled beer and complaining to anyone who would listen that Mawat had prevented him from pressing Iriden's clear, decisive advantage against the Tell. That he had delayed and had only a small victory when he might have acted immediately and gained a large one. That the Lys's heir was timid and indecisive, that if only he, Lord Airu, had been in full command that day, he would have fallen on the assembled Tell forces without delay, ravaged the territory beyond the hills and made sure that the Tell would never trouble Iriden again. That when the day came for Mawat to take the bench in Raven Tower, Airu, in command of the border forces at long last, would not make the same mistakes. Mawat's father would not receive Airu, but Hebal did, and several of the directions. Though, as I'm sure you're already aware, some of those directions did not have as high an opinion of Lord Airu as he doubtless would have wished. But he found Hebal a friendly listener. After all, Airu's father is one of the directions, and Hebal at that time was courting any direction who might support him in the future. And perhaps Hebal, with an eye toward moving the bench across the strait, was glad to hear from someone who promised to rid him of a distraction that would surely make that move seem unwise or dangerous for Iriden. On the other side of the forest, Mawat ordered the regular patrols kept up, even though the Tell had not shown themselves since the attack on the camp. Not even so much as the smallest raid. The farms and villages south of the forest sat safe under the snow all winter, and the riders and messengers Mawat sent out saw nothing. Except I heard for one boy, who'd taken a message to the next camp, alone under the grey sky, in the snow-covered quiet, and seen what he thought was a lynx, atop one of those hills that marked the southern edge of Iriden. It didn't move as he rode by, and he had the uncomfortable impression that it was staring at him. The lynx, of course, is the preferred shape of the god the Tell call, Stalker. The boy reported what he'd seen, but everyone he told laughed at him for being unsettled by such a small thing. Lynxes were hardly uncommon after all. And so when he returned, the hilltop had been empty this time, he went to you, knowing that you would take him seriously. Knowing, no doubt, that you had Mawat's ear. You reported this to Mawat, who said, "Maybe it was her, and I don't think the Tell will be able to make that bargain with her again, but who knows? They very nearly succeeded this time. They would have if Airu had been in command. Who knows what might have happened then? The Raven would have protected Iriden, no question, but I imagine we'd have lost a good deal of our forces, if not all of them. And then where would Iriden be? And something has changed among the Tell. Let's see what our spies bring us." But all that winter, no messages came from over the hills. After the sun went down on Vastai, after your supper of bean porridge and flatbread with salt and thick sour milk, you went up to your room, rolled up the thin woolen blanket, and took it down the stairs and out into the square for Mawat.
"Thank the Raven,"
he said, voice trembling with cold.
"I thought you'd never come, and I was going to freeze to death."
You handed him the blanket, and he threw it around his shoulders.
"I swear, these stones are made of ice."
"I'm sure you don't have to sit here all night, my lord," you said. "I'm not sure people who do this generally do. Or even if they do, there's no one here now. You could come inside for the night and go out again in the morning."
"I'm sure I could,"
replied Mawat.
And then my uncle, or the good Lord Radihor, whatever difference there may be between the two of them, will doubtless be happy to tell anyone who'll listen that obviously I'm not serious about this and can be safely ignored.
Very possibly, my lord, you conceded.
There's no possibly about it,
he snapped, and then, after a pause to collect himself,
who sought you out today?
The Julans,
you told him.
There's something odd there,
Mowat observed. The only worthwhile thing across the strait is Ardvustir's harbour. Without that, Ardvustir is nothing.
It's what comes through there that matters. What else could there be that they would want so badly?
Your glance flickered over to where two guards stood before the closed fortress gate. Though neither seemed to be looking at you or at Mowat, and both your voices had been too low to carry so far, even across bare echoing stone.
"What comes through Ardvustir?"
you asked, still standing, looking down at blanket-wrapped Mowat.
"Everything."
Mowat gave a small laugh.
"Silk, jewels, furs, dried fish, salt, spices and wine, tin and copper and iron and glass, slaves."
"The Julan I talked to said he had heard there might be gold in the far north."
Mowat made a sceptical noise.
"There's nothing in the far north but ice, maybe fish, whales."
He frowned.
"I suppose whales are a sort of fish."
"It depends on how one defines fish."
"There may or may not be gold, but the Julan I talked to didn't seem worried about not finding any. Of course, if they found gold, they'd likely want to be able to cross the strait freely to get it back home as safely and quickly as possible."
"And gold or no gold, control of the strait is a prize worth having, worth the risk of whispering sedition into your ear."
"But my lord, Jula is so very far away, to be so concerned with us."
"Maybe. Keep listening, will you? Learn what you can."
"Yes, my lord."
"In the meantime, I fully expect my uncle to bring pressure to bear once he's decided I'm serious. I'll be in danger then. You'll be in danger too, possibly more danger. My uncle can't afford to remove me in any obvious way while I'm here. And I'm not sure even sitting on the bench could protect my uncle from the people of Vastai, let alone the Directions and the Silent, if he openly interfered with me while I sit here. But you... watch your back."
"Yes, my lord."
"But for the moment..."
Mowat asked with a shiver.
"Do you think you could bring me some mulled beer?"
The next morning you left the guest house early, ignoring the Julans as they sat at breakfast, and set off across town. You seemed not to have any particular goal in mind, but strolled one way and then another. Had you ever been to a town as large as Vastai? Small as it is in comparison with Ardvustir across the strait, I think few towns in Iriden can come close to Vastai. Did you think about what it was you saw, heard, smelled as you walked? As you came through the far corner of the town where the tanners worked, did you wonder how it was that the stench of piss and rotting flesh you wrinkled your nose at didn't escape into adjacent neighbourhoods? Did you consider what must have been the source of the fuel the blacksmiths used to heat metal to glowing again and again, as you walked by the workshop and heard hammers ringing? Did you wonder as you passed a well how, with all the people living in Vastai, all the waste they must produce, that water stayed clean and safely drinkable? Did you wonder, walking through a stone-paved square, stopping to look at stalls with goods laid out for sale, bread, some of it studded with dried fruit or spiced with cinnamon, cardamom or saffron, field herbs, cheeses, lengths of woven lichen-dyed wool, orange and green and yellow-brown, new cabbage and last year's apples? Did you wonder why, in a town so close to such a large forest, nearly all the buildings were built mostly of stone? Possibly not. But I take you for a thoughtful person.
So perhaps you did.
You stopped in front of Vastai's House of the Silent. This is one of the few buildings in the city made almost entirely of wood, and before the raven came, it was well outside what was then a largish village. The fence fluttered with strips and strings of blood-spotted wool, offerings tied to the pails, teeth, animal or human, eggs or feathers, never ravens, hair. The ground inside this fence is dirt and grass, a gravel path leading to its darkened door, a tall wooden stake beside it, bulge-eyed and gape-mouthed. The path is surrounded by a flock of smaller stakes, each one with a strip of cloth tied to it, or a tuft of hair, each stake's upper end smeared with blood. There is no gate barring the entrance to that yard. For the most part, no Iridani would dare enter who was not eligible to do so. The stakes are petitions to a god who has not granted one in decades, but still the Iridani bring them, and if the god of the silent has recovered any power at all, even the slightest bit, it is my hope that these constant requests drain it away before it can do the god any good. I wish I could say that the god of the silent is dead, but I dare not, because I do not know whether or not that's true. The street you stood on led straight to the square in front of the fortress gate. You and Mawat had ridden past here the day you arrived, but paid little or no attention to this building. At first I thought perhaps you intended to make an offering, but you only watched as three young women went up to a relatively empty stretch of fence, and each pricked a fingertip to bleed on narrow strips of cloth they then used to tie lengths of their hair to a wooden slat, muttering prayers the while. In Vastai, this is usually part of a petition for the god of the silent to send one a good husband and a happy marriage. These three, however, were asking for the forest to preserve their friendship so long as they lived and keep undesirable complications like husbands far from their doors. No one else approached the house, but nearly everyone who passed it muttered some prayer or made a quick gesture of reverence. Well, but it wasn't the time for anything more than small passing devotions. More would happen in the proper season, in the dark of the night, where no one would see but those respectable matrons who had achieved initiation into the secrets of the silent. That god was still worshipped, though to someone unfamiliar with Iriden or the forest itself, it might seem that this place was strangely abandoned. You turned and walked to the guest house to find a tower servant in a black overshirt drinking beer and warily eyeing the Julans. The servant stood as you came in. "You are Aeolo, aide to the Lord Mawat?" he asked. "I am." You said no more than that. He drank the last of the beer and set the cup down on the nearby table. "The Raven's Lease commands your presence." The servant led you past Mawat, who affected to ignore you, into the fortress, where everyone passing also affected to ignore you, into the tower, and up the stairs to the room where Mawat had taken you when you'd first arrived. Today there were no Julans, no councillors or courtiers, only Hibal, white-clad, sitting on the carved bench on the dais, and not far from him, a round three-legged iron brazier, lit to drive some of the chill from the bare stone room.
"Aeolo," he said. "It is Aeolo, isn't it?"
You dropped your gaze to the stone floor.
"Raven's Lease," you said, stiff and formal.
"I hear you've served with my nephew in the field. You must be capable, or he wouldn't have wasted his time on you. And you must know by now what he's like."
Still you kept your gaze fastened on your feet. Did you hear, Did you feel that low vibration, that ever-present grinding?
Raven's lace? I'm sure I don't know what you mean.
Come now, Aeolo.
You shivered just lightly, whether from the chill of the room or from the unnerving similarity of Hibal's voice to Mawat's.
You have not served any amount of time with Mawat without learning that he has a temper. He controls it better these days than when he was a child, certainly, and still he locked himself into his room for nearly 2 days, and left you outside, unprovided for, with no orders. I'm glad Mother Zezume took care of you, but if she hadn't, what would you have done?
He paused, perhaps waiting for you to answer, but you stared fixedly at the floor, silent.
But this?
He gestured outward, indicating no doubt that square in front of the fortress gate where Mawat still sat.
This is not a mere fit of temper. This is sedition, a direct challenge to my authority. It is a dangerous game my nephew is playing. I thought perhaps the cold and discomfort would drive him indoors, but he is apparently determined to do this to rouse the people of Vastai against me, and perhaps even of Iraden.
Hibal shook his head sadly, although you could not see it.
This from the man who wants so badly to sit on the bench. He is willing enough to undermine the legitimacy of the very office he so badly wishes to hold, no matter what damage he may do to Iraden in the process. Can you imagine such a person in charge of Iraden's affairs?
You took an apprehensive breath.
Forgive me for speaking plainly,
you began. Your words rushed, as though you had nerved yourself to speak, and had forced the words out of your mouth quickly, before you could think better of it.
Please,
Hibal entreated.
Please do speak plainly.
The Lord Mawat has been sorely tried these past few days,
you said.
The Lord Mawat is not alone in that,
retorted Hibal,
though he often forgets that he is not the only person whose feelings matter. His father was much the same, I am sorry to say, even to the point of sometimes forgetting his duty to Iraden in his pursuit of his personal desires.
You did not reply to this, and you did a fair job of hiding your trembling. Fear, I think, and consternation, and I cannot blame you for that.
I understand that my nephew is upset. I understand that he doesn't want to believe the worst of his own father. I would have wanted to break the news to him more gently, but he rushed in here as soon as he arrived.
Your head jerked just a bit, as though you were about to look up, about to protest that it had been Hibal who had summoned Mawat here, Hibal who had chosen that time.
Listen, Aeolo. I have done this not just for Iradan's sake, but for Mawat's. The lease is unpaid, and when we asked the raven for guidance, the reply was, "This is unacceptable. There will be a reckoning." Now, that might be a reckoning Mawat's father will face, but it could mean something else. What if the new instrument hatches, and the raven, now able to speak clearly and publicly, demands an immediate payment of the lease from whoever has been confirmed to the bench? I'm taking a risk here.
Did you think to yourself that this was an odd way to put that? When late or soon, payment would be demanded of any lease? Maybe. You closed your eyes, swayed a little, and took a deep, calming breath. Hibal continued.
If Mawat were to have taken the bench and the instrument hatch and demand immediate payment, it would be a tragedy. He's so young and he has no heir. By taking the bench, I thought to prevent this. If so needed, I can pay and leave Mawat to take the bench as he always would have. And, moreover, If I'm fortunate enough to live more than a few weeks, he will have time to temper his spirits, to learn patience, before he is given Elise's power. Perhaps you can help him do that. I think you can. But you must persuade him to leave off this dangerous course.
You took another deep breath, spent a moment clearing the expression from your face as best you could, and then looked up.
Do you think, Hibal continued, that Mother Jejume would have confirmed me as Lys if this were to Mawat's disadvantage?
Raven's Lys, you said then.
I am just the son of a farmer. I don't know about these things. How does the raven speak when he has no instrument to speak with?
Hibal frowned.
It's more difficult between instruments. It's complicated.
Raven's Lys, you replied. The Lord Mawat said he had the right to ask the raven for answers.
So he does, said Hibal. And if he had asked to speak to the raven instead of locking himself in his room and then making a spectacle of himself in front of all Vastai by attacking me, he'd have had an answer by now.
I think you tried to hide it, but your doubt showed on your face.
You remembered surely that Mawat had demanded just that, and Hibal had put him off.
But your loyalty to Mawat speaks well of you. He trusts you. And I can see why. Iraden needs you to use that trust for all our good, for Mawat's good. Come, I will summon the Lord Radihor, and you may ask what questions you like of the raven in Mawat's stead. Perhaps the answers you bring him will help him to remember his duty.
When Hibal had explained to Radihor what he wanted, Radihor frankly stared at you, standing there before the bench.
"Young man," he said, apparently having reached some conclusion or solved some puzzle, "you are going to have an experience few of your station have had. I would advise you to remain sensible of this."
"My lord," you said, bowing your head, perhaps in deference, perhaps to hide the expression on your face.
"Assuredly," Radihor continued, "this would not even enter the realm of serious possibility, if not for the sake of the Lys's heir. Had he not chosen to behave so outrageously toward the raven's Lys, he might be standing here himself. But, as you see, the Lys still wishes to do what is right concerning his heir."
"I am only here on account of the Lord Mawat," you said, head still bowed so that your grimace of fear, of irritation, of anger, was not visible to him.
"It is indeed a privilege," agreed Hibal. "We grant it, as the Lord Radihor has said, because of Mawat. Hopefully, answers from the raven, which he might have sought himself before taking the drastic step of attempting to stir up the people of Vastai, hopefully, what answers the raven might give will settle all doubts about this matter."
You smoothed over your expression and looked up.
"Raven's Lys, did you not say the raven's last reply on this matter, when questioned, was equivocal?"
Radihor said, "The raven replies at such times, between instruments I mean, are always equivocal. One must have the skill and the wisdom to understand is all. You are young and impetuous yet, and such a thought does not come naturally to you, no doubt. But you will learn as the years go by that the apparent is not always the truth."
"No doubt, my lord," you said, bowing again.
"Come,
said Hibal, rising from the bench.
Patience is not a young man's virtue, and I don't doubt we are trying Aiolo's.
He strode off the dais to the room's single entrance, those stone steps that led above and below. Radahor followed, and you followed Radahor, up those stairs, past the next level, its entrance covered with blue and yellow hangings, past two black liveried servants who stepped aside at Hibal's approach, and farther up, onto the roof of the Tower of Vastai. You blinked and braced yourself as the wind hit you. The spring sky was blue and near cloudless, and the low wall that circled the tower's top did lessen the strength of the breeze there, but it was still enough to blow away much of the sunshine's warmth. If you looked north, you could see the grey-blue water, wrinkled and rippled with waves, and the white sails of the boats passing. You would have had to step up to the northern wall to see the ones in Vastai's own harbour, but you would have seen merely by lifting your gaze the white quays of Ardvustia across the strait, the mass of spars and sails, and past those the blocky huddle of warehouses, the rest of the city spreading out beyond. To the southeast lay the shoulder sea, to the northwest the open ocean stretched away to the horizon. If you had turned around, you would have seen Vastai town, meadows, and the apparently endless forest beyond.
"It's quite a view," said Hibal. "Not many have seen it."
"A signal honour, young man," agreed Radahor. "Be sensible of it."
"My lord," you said. The roof was, like the audience room, mostly empty. A few stone seats were placed at intervals along the wall, and in the very centre of the roof, a platform some 4 feet high, on which sat a tangled mass of twigs and sticks.
"That's it," Hibal said to you. "That is the raven's nest."
He gestured you closer.
"Keep a few feet away. Only the lease or the air can go any closer. But as you're already up here, you may as well look. Look, and report every particular to Mawat, so he knows I've dealt honestly with you."
You stepped cautiously forward, gazed unblinking at the brown speckled green egg in the centre of the nest, cushioned with fur and feathers, and here and there strips and shreds of woven wool. Slowly you circled the nest on its platform, staring as though you needed to see it from all angles before you could believe what you had seen, or as though you were trying to make some sort of sense out of what you saw. Halfway around you stopped, your attention drawn by a wide, shallow bowl of water, and a few feet away from that, the dismembered carcass of a rabbit, and beyond that, the dark emptiness of another entrance to the roof, another set of stairs entirely from the one you had just ascended.
"The bird that laid the new instrument's egg must be fed," said Hibal, noting the direction of your gaze. "And so must the instrument itself when it hatches. It is one of the duties of the lease to attend to the instrument's daily needs."
"This is true, although the procuring and the fetching and carrying is all done by servants. It is only the last part, the actual offering of these things to the raven, that the lease regularly does."
"Of course, raven's lease," you murmured,
ducking your head again briefly, tearing your gaze away from that second entrance that you'd seen no sign of anywhere but here, wondering, I imagine, where it led, and finishing your circuit of the raven's nest. Radahor nodded approvingly.
"Yes, yes, I see that you feel it, the reverence any Iradini must have for the god who has given us so much."
"And the trees in the forest," you said,
I'm sure without thinking, making a small quick gesture with your left hand. This seemed to amuse Hibal.
Very reverent, I'm glad to see it.
Indeed, agreed Radihor, though he seemed somewhat taken aback by your words. The point is, the important thing to remember that one should wish to impress upon you, young man.
He stopped, seemingly at a loss for a moment, and then found his way forward again.
Is that not just anyone can be Raven's Lease? One is not only born to it, but brought up to it. There are few, very few, who might be able to even be considered for the bench.
So the Raven's Lease explained, my lord, you said, your voice solemn. If I am not mistaken, you had resolved on some course of action or other, some stratagem suggested or confirmed by something you had just seen or heard.
How does it work, my lord? What do I need to do?
Hibal nodded at Radihor, who drew from his robe a black silk bag embroidered with gold.
Being still in the egg, said Radihor, the instrument has no mouth with which to speak. Or, he added, it may, depending you understand how far along the egg is. But even so, even if the new instrument is old enough to have a mouth, to have a beak, to be able to make sound, it is not an easy thing to do, or beneficial for the instrument itself, to speak in that way from inside the unhatched egg.
He looked at you, as if awaiting some response.
No, my lord. Now you explain it, I can see just what you mean,
you said, to all appearances still sincerely respectful.
And so,
Radihor continued with an approving nod,
one asks the question in the proper form.
He looked over at Hibal.
Your pardon, Raven's Lease. What is the question we will be asking?
Hibal looked at you.
Well, Aeolo, what three or maybe four questions do you think it would set Mawat's mind at ease to have the answers to?
Raven's Lease, I may ask any question my Lord Mawat might ask.
Or that you, in your best judgment, think might settle some doubt or anxiety of his for his good and the good of Vastai and Iriden?
Hibal replied.
As I said before, he might have been standing here himself if not for his current open defiance. But do not waste our time or try the Raven's patience. You would not be here if I thought that likely, but I give you the warning in any event.
You looked at the nest, frowning. Seemed to ponder for a bit, though I'm fairly sure you had been considering what questions to ask as you came up the stairs, and had, moreover, settled on one in particular when you'd seen that other set of steps.
I am ready, Raven's Lease,
you said at last.
This is my first question. Where was my Lord Mawat's father when the last instrument died?
Your question startled Radihor, and he dropped the black silk bag. It fell to the stone pavement, and out of it tumbled a half dozen polished wood discs inlaid with copper.
I didn't mean to offend, my lords,
you said, as Hibal and Radihor stared in alarm at the scatter of discs.
I was instructed to ask what my Lord Mawat would ask, or what might settle his mind if answered. He is so unwilling to believe that his father has fled. But if the Raven himself says it, or if the Raven by his answers shows that as things were, there can be no other conclusion to reach, then he will have to face the truth of the matter.
I see,
said Hibal, still staring at the tokens on the ground.
I understand you. Radihor, pick up the tokens and we'll ask the question properly.
I think, Raven's Lease,
Radihor replied,
that we must take the answer we have been given. Such accidents are really without significance in this place, at such a time.
I suppose so,
agreed Hibal.
Could you see his reluctance? Could you read the answer?
Radihor could read it, and he spoke what he read out loud for you.
Can you hear me below?
Forgive me, my lords, you protested. That doesn't make any sense to me, and I fear it will make none to my lord Mawat.
It is the answer we have been given,
Radihor told you, and bent to retrieve the bag and returned the spilled tokens to it.
Before you ask the next, give me a moment to prepare.
He straightened, gave the bag a shake or two, and loosened its mouth, and then held it before him on the palms of his outstretched hands.
Raven of Iriden, God of Vastai, said Hibal. When you came to Vastai, you promised to work for the profit and good of Iriden. To that same end, we are here to ask for assistance in matters of state. I am your lease, confirmed by the Silent, and your tokens are in the hand of Radihor, chief of the Council of the Directions, as required by the old agreement. We need and desire your answers and advice.
Radihor said, Now ask your next question, young man.
Where is the Lord Mawat's father now?
You asked. Radihor tilted the bag, shook it until tokens tumbled out, frowned, puzzling out the results.
A thing that's old, the stars.
No.
Negation of the stars. Tree, bear, water.
You and Radihor were both looking at the tokens, not at Hibal, who seemed to be visibly relieved at this answer.
We have already asked this question and received a similarly incomprehensible reply. This is the sort of answer the raven gives at this time, for whatever reason.
It must mean, I think, said Radihor, that the Lord Mawat's father is in some cold place where there is no sight of the stars, some dark northern wilderness, perhaps.
Their Lord Radihor has a great deal of experience in these matters, said Hibal. The chief of the Council of the Directions is always present at these sessions, and he has served through the tenures of two leases, before me, I mean. I would rely on his interpretation.
Raven's lease, you agreed. I know nothing about these matters. I'm sure it's as the Lord Radihor says.
Do you have another question, young man?
Asked Radihor.
Oh, so many questions, I imagine, might have occurred to you then. So many answers you might have wanted, or the answers to which might have helped you to understand what had happened, what was happening, how to turn events in what you believe to be the best direction.
I don't doubt that in that moment many of those questions were there in your thoughts, but I am quite certain you were too shrewd to ask them with Hibal standing, listening, with Radihor watching, judging, sure to alert Hibal to any implications of your questions that Hibal might have missed.
Raven's lease, you said, your voice innocently troubled. You told me to ask questions that might set my Lord Mawat's mind at rest. I am very sure that the Lord Mawat's current extreme behaviour is not only on account of his distress at his father's doubtful fate, but also the strangeness of recent events and his concern for the future of Iriden. The questions I have in mind are proper questions for my Lord Mawat to ask, but in my mouth they might seem presumptuous or even disloyal.
Your hesitation in this becomes you,
said Radehor. But you are speaking for the Lord Mawat.
We understand that, do we not, Ravenslys?
We do, agreed Hebal genially.
This is not a time to be shy or too discreet,
he admonished you, though still smiling.
This matter must be settled in Mawat's mind. He is my heir, after all, and it would be better for Iriden if he would get dressed and resume his duties as heir. Ask what he would like answered. I require it of you.
Two more questions, then, Ravenslys, at your command and with your generous patience. Hebal waved acknowledgement of this, and Radehor said,
I am ready, young man.
My third question, then, is, will the Lord Mawat be Ravenslys in the future? You turned your head toward the clattering tumble of tokens spilling from the bag in Radahor's hands, but I thought your eyes looked, for at least a moment, at Hebal. Some expression crossed Hebal's face, quickly hidden by the resumption of his former pleasant concern.
Can you hear me?
Read Radehor.
He will be, when you bring him here, I will say, hear me, can you hear me?
He will be,
Hebal repeated.
That seems to be a quite emphatic yes, and I think the raven doesn't generally make statements like that about the future, not unqualified ones. And look, the raven says he will say so himself if Mawat comes himself to ask. Report that to your lord, Aeolo. Report it faithfully.
Ravenslys, you acknowledged, as Radehor picked the tokens up and yet again replaced them in the bag. There is one more question that I believe my Lord Mawat would ask, since it touches matters that trouble him.
I am ready,
said Radehor, steadying the bag in the palms of his hands. What, you asked, are the Zulans doing here? Hebal frowned.
They are on their way to the north and want permission to cross the strait, since that's the shortest and safest route to their goal. Surely you can spend a question on some more pressing issue?
Ravenslys, you demurred. I was bidden to ask questions that might set my Lord Mawat's anxieties to rest. What the Zulans want may be one thing. My lord's misgivings are another.
Indeed, indeed,
put in Radehor.
That is very true.
So, my lords, you persisted, with your permission, what are the Zulans doing here? And did they have anything to do with the disappearance of my lord Mawat's father? You, Radehor and Hebal, started and braced yourselves as a sudden gust blew across the tower roof. The bag tipped and fell out of Radehor's hands, and the wind took it, upended it.
Deception. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Radehor read out.
Oh, what a disordered heap this is, one took and piled on another or scattered here and there. Theft to claim another's power. Bring him here. This.
He hesitated.
I'm not sure what order to read these in. Unacceptable. This. Last words. Last chance. Do something. Bring him here. Pay debt.
Or is it. Look at egg?
Or egg debt theft?
What order should I read them in?
I think, Radehor,
said Hebal,
That we should ask this question again. Such a mess as this is unlike the raven's usual answers, or so I understand. No doubt the real reply is mixed in among tokens blown accidentally to the ground. Surely the god would not begrudge us, or Mawat, I should add, a clearer answer than this.
Generally speaking, said Radihor, still frowning in perplexity at the pile of tokens, generally speaking, the raven is impatient with repeated questioning. Generally speaking, an answer is an answer, no matter how confusing or difficult to understand. But perhaps this once it may be called for.
I think so, said Hebal.
And when Radihor had gathered up the tokens and stood again with the bag in his hands,
God of Vastai, why are the Julans here?
You blinked and bowed your head, hoping perhaps to look humbly grateful at this second chance for an answer to your question, perhaps incidentally concealing any expression that might betray the fact that you'd noticed the question had been abbreviated. Radihor shook the bag and tipped it.
Enter.
Another shake.
One.
And by a slow series, tokens falling one by one.
Lamb, offering, cut, ask, nothing, young, over, under, happy, end, apple, return, mend, ever.
He gave a vexed sigh.
It is entirely different. I don't know what to make of it.
Ask nothing, young. Perhaps the raven warns Aiolo, or should I say Mawat, against asking this question,
suggested Hebal.
But he also said, happy end, or no, I see it. Enter one.
That is, Mawat should come back inside. Lamb, offering cart.
The god asks for an offering of a lamb, easy enough to obey. I will order it so for tomorrow. Ask nothing, young. As I have already said, perhaps the raven considers Mawat's doubts to be presumptuous, but for the rest of the tokens all will end well and be well, if Mawat will only mend what he has broken.
Yes,
Radihor muttered, frowning. And then surer,
yes, it must be so, it makes sense.
You will report all that has been said and done here, said Hebal to you. You will tell Mawat everything I have said.
I will, Raven's Lease, you said. Thank you for this generous honour.
I accord it to you for my nephew's sake,
replied Hebal,
and for the sake of Iraden. Remember that. Now go.
The Kaloet priest had convinced the camp not to take revenge for the slaughter at the river camp without my having spoken on the matter. No vengeful expedition went north. Neither had they struck camp. Anywhere else they might go was likely already occupied, and in any event, the elders thought that this place was too far away to be easily reached. And if the Tzoksh did come, the camp would not be taken by surprise, as the river camp had been.
And besides, said one elder, we have strength and patience to aid us.
Still, they wisely did not put all their reliance on my aid. Hunters made a point of scouting, and everyone watched the surrounding land with more than usual attention, and uneventful days had gone by. So at the myriad's declaration that the Tzoksh had come, I looked around. The small stream below ran along a line of low hills, of which mine was one. On the other side of the stream lay gently undulating ground, grass-covered, with here and there the occasional slouching stand of low shrubs or an outcrop of lichened rock. It was not terrain that would hide attack as well, but the hills on the northwest of the camp might hide an enemy's approach. I looked, and did not see anything but grass and more hills,
but that might only mean the potential attackers were well hidden or farther away than I saw. But it did not matter what I saw. The myriad had surely spoken truly. Without thinking, I caused the priest's bag of tokens to upend itself and spill a warning onto the ground. Within minutes, she was out of her tent and into her neighbour's. "They must arm themselves," I said to the myriad. "The children looking for berries by the river must go indoors immediately. Why does the priest not sound a general alarm?" A child ran out of the tent the priest had gone into, straight to the next tent along the way.
"I think she has," said the myriad. "It is wise for the people to conduct themselves in such a way that the raiders think they have the advantage of surprise, even though they no longer do."
Surely, being warned, the people below might arm themselves immediately and go out to destroy the raiders.
"Tell me, friend of mine, why do you not just speak the raiders gone?"
Below, a woman came out of the tent the child had run into. She carried a basket of mushrooms calmly and deliberately to another nearby tent. I do not know precisely where they are or what resources they may have. I replied, "I might speak too generally and cause unforeseen difficulties for myself or for the people of this camp, affecting either more than I intended or less. I might unknowingly injure the people below, when I would prefer not to do that. I might cause some future harm I have not predicted."
"Just so," said the myriad. "Or you might unknowing say something impossible and thereby injure or even kill yourself."
"Yes," I agreed.
"The humans must do more than speak in this situation, but the principle is similar. They would know more and think how best to use what advantage they have. Let us watch."
At that moment, there was, the best way I can describe it is to say there was an empty space in my awareness. And then, suddenly, I seemed to hear the priest cry out to me, and the camp was no longer quiet and peaceful below me. Pale-skinned, pale-haired Tsoch walked from tent to tent, talking and laughing. The priest lay before the door of her own tent, a knife in her throat, blood pooling beneath her, her hands twitching as though making some effort to move, to take hold of the knife, and then she was still dead. The priest, who had sought out my company since she could crawl, who spoke comfortably and confidently to me, even fondly sometimes as though I were her friend.
"Oh,"
cried the myriad beside me, a keening whine.
"Oh, someone will regret this, and I will take care that it is not I. What god agreed to help them in this fashion?"
For it made sense that only a god could have clouded our awareness in such a way. But I was not paying much attention to the myriad or her conclusions about how this had been accomplished. The fact that somehow my, and it was easy to gather the myriad's awareness, had been occluded was of secondary importance somehow to the fact that the priest had somehow managed to call to me, and I had awakened, but too late to save her. The sense of wrongness, of personal offence, she had been my priest, my friend, overwhelmed me.
"The god who did this,"
I began. The myriad interrupted.
"Wait! I advise you to think more carefully and learn more before you say this."
"Is dead,"
I continued. The effect of my words struck me as though they were a lump of near molten iron hurtling from the heavens. I was suddenly aware of little more than weakness and pain and the stone surrounding me. Was I not that stone? I couldn't tell. Nothing seemed right. I reeled. For how long, I did not know. After a while, I was able to look outward from myself. I found only darkness and ice. I was covered and cased in ice and snow. Winter had come. There would be no one in the camp, not in this season. I did not try to remove the ice, but lay still beneath it, resistless, exhausted. I knew that above me the moon and the stars still circled, that perhaps the sun peaked above the horizon for a few minutes or hours each day, that eventually the daylight would grow longer and warmer, the night-time dark, shorter. It would not be so very long. A single year was nothing to me. Perhaps if I lay quiet and thought of the stars, I would recover some strength. Perhaps people somewhere would make prayers or offerings to me. Even a very small few such would help, I was sure. But what had happened to the people in the camp? What had the myriad done? She had advised me not to speak so impetuously. She had been right. Speaking without thinking first had never been one of my besetting difficulties, but perhaps I was the more vulnerable to it on that account. I had no hard experience to tell me just how bad an idea it might be. Still, I hoped the myriad had helped the people of the camp. And I was sure the god who had hidden the Tzokch attack from me was dead, or else I would be. Dead, or still losing power in a failed, fruitless attempt to make my words true. So more than likely that god was dead. That pleased me. I would wait. And waiting, I discovered that I had not been forgotten. Offerings were still being made, quite a few in fact. I could feel them. Spring would come, and I hoped the Calouette and the Myriad would come shortly thereafter and would answer my questions. They did not come until the spring after that one. The people were fewer than I remembered, wary and more heavily armed, and they set regular lookouts on the hilltops and began digging a ditch around the camp, piling the soil into a rock-lined wall beside it. "Who was the god?" I asked the Myriad when she arrived.
"I could not discover that," she said. "I suspect it was someone small and insignificant, who was not party to any agreements or alliances nor any entanglements that would make attacking your people an obviously dubious idea."
"My people?" I asked, indignant.
"I am not in a mood to be trifled with," she replied with some asperity. "Had you but waited a few minutes and followed my advice and instruction, we might have dealt with the Tzokch quickly enough and possibly even delivered them prisoner to the assembly of the peoples. Instead, you nearly killed yourself and left me not only to deal with the raiders as best I could, but to give you what aid I could afford to prevent your dying. I was left weakened and still have... obligations to fulfill. It has been a trying 2 years, and that almost entirely on your account."
"Why did you not just leave me to die?" I asked, genuinely puzzled.
"Because if you had died, that other god would still have been a factor I would have been obliged to deal with," the Myriad explained. "And because you are my friend. Though, mind you, I am still somewhat out of temper with you."
I thought about that for a while. Here is a story I have heard. The attack on the river camp and the camp below my hillside was not addressed by the Assembly of the Peoples until the next winter. This was not because no complaint had been brought. The few Tzokch present responded angrily to the accusation. Times had certainly been difficult, were difficult for everyone, they said, and there had been theft and raiding all along the nebulous boundaries between peoples. It wasn't as though no Calouette had stolen from their neighbours in the past year after all, and there was a matter before the Assembly even now in which a Calouette was accused of a theft of foxes from Tzokch traps. But most of all, most offensive to them, was the accusation that a god had assisted in the wholesale slaughter of an entire camp and the attempted slaughter of another. "It was a lie," declared the appointed speaker for the Tzokch. "It could be proved a lie. No god of the northern coast, or for that matter any of the areas inland, would take part in such a thing. No Tzokch would be so depraved. It must, they claimed, be some gang of Calouette who had done it, if indeed it had actually happened.
The surviving girls of the river camp cried aloud at this, tore their hair and called on the gods of the peoples to vindicate them. One man snatched up the knife that had been in the priest's throat, brought to the assembly as evidence, and rushed at the Tsokhtch delegation amid cries of horror and dismay from the spectators. Offering violence in this place at this time was a serious offence among the most serious possible within the assembly of the peoples.
"Stop!" cried the myriad,
her voice inaudible among the tumult. But a god's words do not always need to be heard to have effect. The attacker, knife in hand, halted and fell, overset, sprawling to the ground.
"A minute's silence from you all!" cried the myriad,
and the assembled people fell suddenly quiet and looked around, perplexed and angry.
"Hear from me before you break the peace of this camp,"
the myriad said then. And now, with quiet at last, she could be heard.
"I was there, not at the attack on the river camp, but at the second. I was beside the strength and patience of the hill when it happened. Some god spoke much of the camp into sleep, and myself and the foundation of the hills into unconscious stupor. We awoke, I know not how or why, to see people dressed in Tsokhtch furs despoiling the camp. I observed that some god must have spoken us into unawareness, and in anger the strength and patience of the hill spoke the death of that god. The foundation of the hills was a year or more recovering from these uncharacteristically hasty words. I say this plainly. The raiders that day were Tsokhtch. They were assisted by some god. And if that god is not dead, then it is sorely injured and very near death."
In the meantime, the man who had tried to attack the Tsokhtch delegate knelt, weeping and trembling, on the gravelled assembly ground, realizing too late that had it not been for the myriad, his life would certainly have been forfeit. Indeed, a great many unfortunate events might have followed such impetuous violence. Indeed, a great many unfortunate events might have followed such impetuous violence, to the great detriment of many. But quite naturally, the one foremost in his mind was the certainty of his own execution had he succeeded in his attack. The mere attempt had put his life in question, but after much discussion it was agreed that a fine should be imposed on him, to be paid to the Tsokhtch delegates should next year's evidence vindicate them, and paid to the myriad if not. For whatever might happen, he owed her his life. Then and there, he vowed himself a changed man, the special devotee of the myriad, and publicly resolved to deal more patiently and gently with others for the rest of his life. 5 years later, he died in an argument over the ownership of a reindeer calf. I don't think there is any particular lesson to draw from this, but like the account of the rest of these events, I had it from the myriad herself. If I ponder it long enough, as indeed I have had plenty of opportunity to do, I can see several potential lessons or morals one might draw from such a tale, and no doubt many of them would be salutary, or at least salutary for someone. Here is another story I have heard. A young man of the Tsokhtch, out setting snares, felt something drop onto his head. Looking up, he saw a gull bank and fly away. Looking down, he saw the skull of a shrew. It was an odd event. He picked up the skull, meaning to put it in his bag to show later, but the skull spoke to him. He could not understand what it said, but that did not much matter to the young man. A skull stripped of flesh that speaks must, he concluded, be speaking for a god. It so happens that in the very far north, on the icy shores of the northernmost sea, there are many very small gods who have attached themselves to a single family, or even a single person. Generally such gods do small services,
I do not say unimportant ones. On the ice, such small matters can make the difference between life and death. These gods do such things as strengthening fishing nets, or preventing a harpoon line from snapping. They make sparks to start fires, or they turn storm-muddled wanderers toward home. And so the young man thought that this was a fortunate and valuable find. He took it home and showed it to his mother, who advised him to make a bag for it and carry it with him. Moreover, he should speak to it daily. In the meantime, the family would watch their luck, and if small things went well, then the young man should offer some seal fat or an egg to the god. But if things began to go badly for the young man or for the family, he should take the skull and throw it into the sea. Things began to go very well indeed for the young man. No fish slipped out of his net. His snares were always full, and the skull began to speak in words the young man could understand. Haltingly at first, but more fluently as the weeks went by. The god professed itself grateful for the young man's attentions and eager to serve. And so for some weeks things seemed well. Then one day the skull said to the young man,
"In another house in this camp, there is another young man, a very handsome one. I think you would like to come to this young man's attention."
This was true, the young man admitted. But, he informed the skull, that handsome young man did not return our young man's feelings.
"Would he not be impressed," said the skull, "if you could lay wealth at his feet?"
"Possibly," replied the young man, but thought to himself that to pay such a price for the handsome one's affection would render it not only worthless, but repellent.
"To the east and the south of here," said the skull, "is the territory of the Kalawet. They are laden with luxuries from the south, kettles, knives of metal, and so much wood. Do they have any more right to such luxuries than you? I do not think so."
"You may be right," said the young man.
"Listen, then," said the shrew skull. "Why not gather three or four of your bravest, most daring friends, and let me advise you? I can lead you to riches. Riches you can show to that handsome young man. Indeed, with such riches, you would be able to make me such an offering as would help me to secure that handsome young man's love for you."
For a moment, our young man was tempted. Who could blame him? The handsome young man in question was handsome indeed, and intelligent and charming into the bargain. But our young man was tempted only for that moment. In the next, he realized that he was in a great deal of danger. The same shrew skull god that had made things go well for our young man could easily make his life much, much worse.
"Your proposal is an attractive one," said the young man. "Can you really do this?"
"I can," replied the shrew skull.
"Then you are a more powerful god than I had realized," said the young man.
"That I am," said the skull. "Does it not please you to have had such luck as to find me?"
"Indeed,"
said the young man, thinking to himself that he would now like to have such luck as would allow him to lose the skull. But he could think of no better way to be rid of it than to do as his mother had instructed. And so, having told the skull he would bring it to meet his friends, he instead took it out on the water and threw it, bag and all, into the sea. He added a prayer to the drowned one, asking that god to keep the skull in the depths, safely away from any human who might discover it. He told the story to no one, until the news of the raids on the Kalawet reached him, along with an elder asking about unfamiliar gods who might have assisted or even instigated such an expedition. This account was conveyed to the assembly of the peoples, and the assembly concluded
that the arrival of the Skull God was an attempt by some foreign god to meddle in the affairs of the far north, quite possibly to prevent the gods of the north from turning their attention south to the dispute over the strait between Ardvuskdia and Vastai. As I've said, you are used to an Iriden with only two gods, the god of the silent and the raven of Iriden, but there used to be more. Before you left home to become a soldier, did you ever pile stones at a crossroads? Did you name the raven when you did it? Years ago, those were not meant for the raven, no, nor for the silent forest. And when you became a soldier, did your comrades give you a prayer to say before your first battle, a verse dedicating the first blood you drew to the raven, the god of Iriden? That was once a dedication to another god. The defence of Iriden, the mounder-up of skulls, who received the prayers and blood of Iridani warriors. I think the mounder-up of skulls had been a small, quarrelsome god before the raven came, but saw in the god of the silence agreement with the raven an opportunity to grow larger than it might have under the shadow of the forest. Once a small god who delighted in small arguments, it now aspired to be the god of all Iriden's warriors. And look now, it is as I told the myriad. All things change. Now the proud mounder-up of skulls has no more need for offerings, and that name is almost never heard in Iriden or anywhere.